Hello, everybody, and welcome to the next episode of Retail Ramblings. We're on to episode 8. We've had a lot of fun so far having a look at retail in North America and the trends and everything that's going on. And this week, we've got a great episode in store that's going to really look at some trends and have a look at how data is being leveraged in retail today. So we'll start off, as we always do, having a look at what we touched upon in our last episode. So for our winners, we had Henkel for winning a Raff Cycle Award. And our discussion extended onto corporate social responsibility and when profitability trumps sustainability and vice versa. Marshall, who else did we have as our winner in the last episode?
So we had Forever 21, and we spoke about their expansion into the beauty industry with their new concept store called Riley Rose. The store was founded by the two daughters of the Forever 21 founders, and they have some really exciting ideas for how to target millennials and Gen Z folks. Some really great things that they're doing on social as well. So we're very excited to keep watching Riley Rose.
Yeah, fantastic. On the losers, we had GE Appliances just due to a recent lawsuit on a factory fire that they were responsible for.
And we also talked about the sad demise of Toys R Us. You know, they declared bankruptcy in the last month and just doesn't look like they're doing too well. But they are really trying to stay afloat and trying a few innovative things to kind of get back out there.
For the retail roadmap, we had a look at the connected warehouse and the importance of robotics in supply chain management, something that I'm sure that many in our audience hold near and dear to their hearts. So it's a really interesting discussion, and I compel you to go back and have a listen to it and hear where that's kind of going in terms of the retail roadmap.
And on the data dive, we took a look at RFD and beacon technology and how Target is leveraging that to keep shoppers in store and to help them find their way around the stores.
Brilliant. Let's get into this episode's winners and losers. All right, so we're going to jump into this episode's retail winners and losers. And I'm going to start it off. And this particular winner makes me really excited because I don't actually have to make any enemies and I'm going to make a lot of friends with it. But our winner is retail in general and everybody who is involved in retail. Due to the fact that we've seen the biggest growth in retail since 2015 for a particular month. So retail sales in general grew by 1.6%, largely driven by the home improvement space and the autos and truck space. Now, we've obviously talked about it in previous episodes, the devastation and destruction of the natural disasters that we've seen in the United States in particular over the summer and fall of 2017. So this sort of news is a silver lining for the people and the brands involved in those particular areas where so much hardship has occurred, particularly over the summer, late summer and the beginning of the fall. Now, if we have a little bit of a look back at some of the previous numbers in where September stacks up to September last year, it's actually 4.4% higher in the number of sales than September 2016. As well as that, August was a pretty poor month for retail sales. It had failed to meet expectations from a lot of analysts. And that makes the results this month all the better and really promising to see and really indicative of the consumer mentality out there at the moment with retail sales. Despite that, it's not all rosy in retail. Electronic and appliances stores fell by 5.3%. Now, so this is actually worse than a 12-month trend of 3% that's been predicted by a lot of analysts on Wall Street. And it's largely in part due to a shift in sales to other retailers for electronic and appliance products. There's a lot more general mass retailers that sell these products, and therefore the space is extremely competitive. As well as that, there's a relative lack of interest in electrical and technological products at the moment. There is talk that the iPhone, as it generally does every year, will spark up that particular space and spark up that particular vertical. But, you know, Marsha, personally, I don't know how exciting the iPhone as a release is now in comparison to when it was, what it was, say, 5-6 years ago. And I don't hold a lot of confidence for that particular vertical in terms of it really growing based on the
release. I guess we'll see. Like, they do have a couple of really exciting things coming up. I think the iPhone X is super exciting, but the way that it's priced, I don't know how well that's going to move off the shelf, but I would love to get my hands on one of those personally.
Yeah, exactly. And with those high effort purchases, I guess people are more compelled to go into a store and feel and touch the product and really understand what they're buying. But, you know, banking, say, let's use Best Buy as an example, banking the sales on the rest of your product based on the iPhone is a bit of a pretty risky bet, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think so too. This iPhone is just like brought to mind. There was a funny, I think, meme saying that, you know, you could buy like a brick of gold basically for less than this new iPhone costs.
Crazy.
So yeah, we'll see how that moves.
So Marsha, who do you have as our winner this week?
So I have Frank Body, and I am shocked that we haven't talked about this brand yet. It's personally one of my own favorite beauty brands, and they're from Melbourne, Chris.
Yeah, so they're from my hometown, which is really exciting.
We're slacking there. So for those of you that don't know, Frank Body is it's an e-commerce store, and they sell a line of coffee-based beauty products. So they started out with a coffee scrub. Not so recently, they moved into body creams as well that are based on coffee and some other really natural ingredients. And the exciting thing that's been announced in the last couple of weeks is that they're introducing two new lip tints as well to join their line of products. So what I personally love about Frank Body is their whole brand. I mean, if you take a look at their website, they've personified the entire thing as Frank, which is their character, basically. And they, like, their whole website has these sort of like cheeky lines. You know, when you get the package, it says something like, "I can't wait to be on you." If you're leaving the website, it says something, you know, I hate to see you go, but I love checking you out from from behind, something along those lines. So they're kind of borderline, but they're very, very cheeky, and it works really well for them. And they're doing amazingly on social. So they have these two hashtags called Let's Be Frank and The Frank Effect. And if you look those up, like, they have millions of followers and millions of posts on these, especially on Instagram, with women actually posting pictures, and men as well, of them using the scrub. It looks really interesting. It looks like they have kind of like dirt on them. So it kind of gets people questioning what it is. The other thing that's really exciting about this brand is that they started out in e-commerce, like I mentioned, but now they're making their move into brick and mortar. So in North America, their products are now available in Urban Outfitters, which makes perfect sense. It's such a good fit for that kind of brand. So I'm just super excited that they're launching lip products to join their line, and that they're making their way into physical retail as well. So I thought I'd include them as a winner.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And I guess this has not got a great deal to do with retail, but it's really exciting to see a brand from Melbourne kind of do good. And their branding is very Australian, and I love that. It's very, very in your face and very...
Even like the two the lip tints that are joining their range. So there's kind of like a blog post introducing them, and the end of it says, "Pre-sale is available now for the babes that hate waiting." I don't blame you. I can't wait to get on your lips either. That's what I mean about being cheeky, but I think they're doing it right and they're not crossing any lines.
Yeah, and they're obviously an organization that's done their research and understood what it's like to enter into the North American beauty and cosmetics market. Obviously, it's a very competitive vertical at the moment, but it's great to see that they've done their due diligence, they've done their research on how to crack into that, created a sales force that's obviously working very effectively to get into stores such as Urban Outfitters, and subsequently implemented a lot of the strategies that they would have to expand globally.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see them in Sephora or even in Ulta in the next couple of years as well. I think the brand fits really well there too.
I do think I heard that they might be going into Sephora. I don't know for sure, but yeah, like...
It wouldn't be surprising.
Yeah, no. It's really exciting times and really exciting to see an Aussie brand in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've just had Frank Body as one of our winners, and I want to stick with cosmetics and talk about our loser for the week. And we often shine the spotlight on the large multinational organizations, but at the end of the day, Marsha, they're the ones who should be the most accountable to the consumers out there. And L'Oreal is our winner, or our big loser, I should say, for this particular episode, based on a report that's been published that outlines that brands are failing to disclose slavery and trafficking risks across operations at some of the world's top brands, and this includes L'Oreal, but Estee Lauder's also included, and Yves Saint Laurent are other organizations mentioned. And it's really, really, really disappointing considering that L'Oreal only a few weeks ago actually released their human rights policy. So they've come under a lot of criticism, and a lot of it revolves around a product called mica. So mica is a mineral that's used in makeup to make makeup sparkly. And 60% of mica, this resource, comes from India. Now, the problem that L'Oreal has, and the problem that the cosmetics industry in general has with this particular product, is that a lot of it is sourced from illegal mines in a couple of regions in the northeast of India. So 25% of mica that is globally sourced is said to come from illegal mines. And a lot of these illegal mines actually utilize child labor, which is obviously a really, really terrible thing, and a terrible thing for L'Oreal to even be associated with. There are estimations that there's around 20,000 children who are currently employed. And a lot of these cartels use debt bondage as well to ensure that the workers don't leave and they remain loyal to the organization and these illegal mines. It's a problem that isn't necessarily consigned just to L'Oreal. Stephanie Boyd, who is the PR manager at Lush Cosmetics, came out and said that we had no idea just how difficult it would be to cut out mica. As a direct ingredient, it would be easy to identify, but unfortunately, mica remains as part of a complex mix of materials that are used to make color pigments and lusters. So obviously, it's an enormous issue. The problem, I guess, is the lack of transparency that L'Oreal has, and the lack of action that they've really shown to ensure that this doesn't continue to occur. Their response has come out and said that they have zero tolerance for forced labor in its supply chain, and they have a close eye on slavery risks. They're also involved in trying to build child-friendly villages in the northeast of India where government control is less strict. So they're part of an organization that is an amalgamation of two bodies, which is the National Resources Stewardship Council and an Indian NGO called Bachpan Bachao Andolan, and I may have butchered the pronunciation, but this organization basically aims to turn villages and turn children into school instead of mining by working with local communities. So it's great to see L'Oreal involved in that, but obviously they've been recognized as our big loser because they could be doing more, and they're probably not doing enough to recognize the risks associated with slavery in their supply chain.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for a giant like L'Oreal, I mean, they should be all over that, and they need to know that consumers are looking at that and they can't really get away with stuff like that.
Yeah, and if you have a look at the report, and I'd really encourage everybody to go through and look at the report because I had a good dive into that, but there are a lot of at-risk organizations, and I guess it's not a massive priority at the moment, but it was really interesting to see Premier League clubs in the UK recognized as an at-risk organization because they're involved with apparel, they're involved with manufacturing for their brand, and it's really hard to create transparency around slavery in places that it's quite secluded and it's ingrained almost as part of the culture in places like India and Africa as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Marcia, who do we have as the other loser this week?
So this one was a headline that caught my eye. So Halloween is obviously coming up, and you would kind of expect candy brands to be on top of the world right now and to be doing really well. But there was an article that I read, and the headline was, Halloween may bring more tricks than treats for Tootsie Roll Industries, according to a short seller. So I went and took a deeper dive into that one, and that's really unfortunate what's happening with Tootsie Rolls right now. So Tootsie Roll shares are actually down 4.6% this year on Tuesday's close, and the company didn't respond to any requests for comment there. So the short seller that looked into this, they're predicting that the stock could fall as much as 50%. And they're saying that that's because of changing consumer tastes and increasing regulations on sugary snacks. So that's from a report that they found from a hedge fund obtained by The Post. So another thing that was major there is the way that they're getting shelf space in store. So instead of being at eye level, Tootsie Roll products are found routinely to be at the bottom of shelves in big retailers like Walmart, Duane Reade, and Target. And that's really true. Like, now that I think of it, I do remember seeing them always kind of at the bottom. And there's a lot more innovative brands that are more on top. Also, the brand is not present in checkout lines, which is huge for anything like candy or gum. You know, that's just another great spot to be to catch consumers' attention, and they're no longer there. So that's really unfortunate. So with that, the reason that they're kind of being put behind is that their historical success has been tied to nostalgia. You know, they're a brand that's been around for a long time, and consumers recognize it, and they kind of remember it from their own childhood. But other brands are kind of, you know, they're killing them because they're innovating. So, for example, Hershey's, they're experimenting with flavors that blur the line between healthy and indulgent snacking. And a lot of other brands are doing some really exciting things, whereas Tootsie Rolls have kind of stayed exactly the same. So they're our loser for the week.
Yeah, it's really hard for, I imagine, their field sales team when they're up against competition that is so innovative, and you're kind of selling a product based on nostalgia, and we all know that the trends in the industry are not necessarily rewarding that kind of brand at this particular point in time. So I, to be brutally honest, do not even know what a Tootsie Roll is.
Oh.
but it is definitely a shame to see them go, you know, not perform as much as they're expected to perform around this time of the year. But again, we keep talking about it, we keep harping about it, and innovation is essential for anybody to continue to strive in today's marketplace.
For sure. Okay, so maybe I'll help raise their sales a little bit. I'll buy some for you, Chris, so you can try them, because they are really good.
Are they? What are they?
They're these sort of like caramel chewy sort of candies.
Okay, I think I know what you're talking about. We got something called Fantails in Australia. But anyway, I'll let everybody out in the audience Google a Fantail, and you can taste a real confectionery.
Sounds good. So up next, we're going to jump into the retail roadmap. And this is the area of the podcast where we look at where retail is moving in the future. And we really like to see how companies are looking at data to be able to propel themselves forward. So what I want to talk about this week is independent beauty brands. And they're really having a moment. They're all over the news recently. So with independent beauty brands, you know, packaging is huge. But also it's all about the founder and the story of these brands that are really pushing them forward. So according to a report by Euromonitor, the international beauty industry grew by 5% in 2016, whereas the data showed that indie beauty brands are increasing by 43%. I mean, that's a huge number there.
Yeah, it's a crazy number.
Yeah. So as a result, these types of companies have demanded really big price tags from the biggest players. Last year, an acquisition of IT Cosmetics cost L'Oreal $1.2 billion, crazy, while Too Faced cost Estee Lauder $1.5 billion. And overall, 66 privately held beauty brands were picked up by major companies in 2016. And I'm sure that number is going to be even higher when we see it at the end of 2017. So what I found really interesting is that now department stores are jumping on this trend as well, and it's obviously because they need a traffic boost. So Neiman Marcus was an example that that jumped out to me this week, and they're kind of the latest to dust off their beauty counters with a new partnership with something called Indie Beauty Expo, which is a platform that brings new beauty brands to market. So starting very recently, 15 brands under the Indie Beauty Expo umbrella will be on sale at Neiman Marcus, and a portion of the products are going to be exclusive to the department store, which I'm sure is going to bring a big boost to Neiman Marcus. So this is a limited run partnership. It's going to last until inventory sells out. But Neiman Marcus's beauty VP and merchandise manager said that basically they're using this as a testing ground for bringing indie beauty brands in their stores on a permanent basis. So after this period of testing ends, what they're planning to do is to review each brand's traction after the event, and they're really hoping to bring many of them into the permanent assortment in their stores. So obviously this is where data comes in. They're going to be looking at how each brand is performing, how they're doing around maybe promotional times or maybe closer to the holidays, and they can really, you know, kind of judge it from there and see what makes sense to keep on board. So data is going to be huge there. Overall, I think the big takeaway here is that in each of these cases, customers are really dictating beauty trends. That's really exciting to see. So that's what I wanted to talk about for the retail roadmap.
Yeah, and I think added on to that, and I'll kind of bring this up as a discussion point, but But is the necessity for agility, right? And we talk about, you talk about changing consumer trends and the changing consumer preferences. But the thing is, the speed in which those preferences and those trends are changing is so much more accelerated than what it would have been, say, 15, 20, 50 years ago. And I think that's why you're seeing these indie brands be so successful, is that they're so responsive to the marketplace. I had the luck of going to a retail conference in the middle of the week, and that was the reoccurring theme, is that a lot of these smaller brands, and it stretches across to the home improvement industry, to the electronics industry, have the ability and the agility to be able to adapt a lot quicker to change than what large multinational organizations have. And then I guess, Marsha, it's a difficult question. Obviously, everybody in our everybody who listens to this is in retail. How do you, at such a large organization, kind of adapt and evolve in a way that keeps up with these small beauty brands? Is there a way to do it? Is there anything that you've seen, Marsha, that allows brands to kind of do that?
So sorry, let me just clarify the question here. Are you talking about bigger cosmetics beauty brands that are competing directly with these?
Yeah, exactly, brands? Exactly.
So with there, I mean, I know we harp on this all the time, but again, it's innovation and being open to change. I know, for example, just this week, I heard that Maybelline is changing their tagline.
Yep.
I can't think off the top of my head what they're changing it to, but do you remember?
I can't remember, no.
Okay, so maybe we'll add that in the show notes, but they've had this tagline for, you know, years, and they're experimenting with it and they're changing it. And I think that's what these big brands need to be doing. They need to be looking at what's working and what's not working, and be able to be agile and to be able to change when they need to.
Is there any brand you can think of off the top of your head? You've used Maybelline as an example of it, and the brand that's responded really well to the, I guess, to the hypersensitivity the industry has to change at the moment?
I think L'Oreal is another great example, and we did talk about them in the past with how they're using virtual reality rooms to be able to test their assortment and to be able to see how things look on shelf. Also, they're being really smart. I mean, I spoke about them at the beginning of the section of the podcast. You know, they made some acquisitions to really expand their product line and get into this indie beauty trend.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then in terms of big retailers, so the example that I spoke about at length was Neiman Marcus. But we all know that Nordstrom and Macy's, they've also have seen declines in their foot traffic, but they've also made similar moves.
Yeah.
And actually, Saks Fifth Avenue as well. So in the past year, they had some pop-up stores open in partnership with Korean Beauty, selling their Glow recipe. So they had 50 Korean beauty and skincare brands that they brought under their umbrella. So I think in summary, it's really like it's about innovation. It's about watching what's happening in the market and bringing your brand in there, bringing it into the conversation.
Yeah, and one specific example I can think of is Estee Lauder, and actually something that isn't necessarily a positive move, but shows that they maybe are being responsive to changes. They're getting rid of Estee Edit, and we had a long discussion about that. I think it's in episode 4, but it does show that it's not all doom and gloom for these large organizations. It's kind of about building that culture, and I think cosmetics companies naturally lend themselves to a culture that's obviously a lot more fluid than, say, what a home improvement organization is. But the marketplaces are also very different, and the amount of change that you know home improvement organizations can bring in is obviously a little less reduced. And something like looking at point of sale data might be something that seems like such a small thing, but that actually for a home improvement company could make all the difference between, say, winning and losing with their competition. So it is a really exciting time. We always want to talk about this stuff, and if you guys have got some suggestions out in the audience of organizations that you know, large organizations that you may work for, you may have colleagues that work for that are really responsive to change, we'd love to talk about them as a winner, particularly in the home improvement space, because it's something that really interests us.
Yeah, definitely let us know. We'd love to get that engagement from you guys.
Okay, so we're into our final section for this particular episode, and we'll be doing the data dive to finish us off. And this week I want to look at an organization called Ripple Metrics, and I kind of want to speak about them, but I also want to talk about their software and what it actually means for retail in general. So before I do that, I'll give a little bit of a brief overview of stuff that we've already talked about in previous episodes. So if this is your first episode that you've listened to or you haven't listened in a while, I'd strongly suggest go back and listen to some of the other ones. But we've spoken about RFID tags, beacons, and a lot of consumer tracking in store. And we've also talked about the death of bricks and mortar, pardon me, and how that isn't actually a reality And the reality is much more complicated than that. And the reality is a lot more around omnichannel and making sure that your online presence is completely consistent with your offline and bricks and mortar presence. And we've also talked about experiential. So making sure that experience in store is really important. The reason that I bring up these three things is that Ripple Metrics is kind of the conversion of all these three different areas. Ripple Metrics is a Canadian organization that uses sensors and algorithms to anonymously and accurately track visitor movement in store. And one of their key pieces of technology differentiates staff from shoppers. So that's something that's always been quite difficult for brands when looking at foot traffic. They provide many similar metrics that online users to measure performance. So metrics include customer presence, return frequency, stay time within the store, and also the customer journey, which is extremely important. Further from that, and this is something that we've found with our own application, is that it's really important to have this all available on a cloud-based dashboard, which is what Ripple Metrics does as well. What I want to do is I want to pass across, Marcia, a quote from the marketing manager at Ripple Metrics, Ravinder Sanger.
Let's hear it.
So if I can find my paper. The quote goes, "In the new world of retailing, consumers can make purchases anywhere, so why should they come into your store? The fact is that people still enjoy shopping in bricks and mortar stores for several reasons, including the opportunity for socializing, the ability to touch and feel the products they want to purchase, and to experience something unique while in the store." Experience is the key term, and this is me paraphrasing here, but we've actually spoken about that at length in our previous episode. But Ravinder goes on to say, retailers who create in-store experiences with their displays or hold in-store events and have product available to try, test, or taste are winning over customers. It makes sense. Now, their product is all about measuring the in-store shopping experience, and something that's extremely important. In-store now doesn't always directly lead to a purchase, and looking at just your purchase orders is akin to making a really, really bad move. So engagement is the core focus of their product, and I guess it's indicative of where retail is in general and having a look at engagement in general. It kind of begs the question as well, and some conversation points, Marsha, that we've spoken about in the past, is marketers have struggled to attribute dollars to ROI. And when we look at the movement from online to offline and this trend that's happening, Foursquare, Facebook, Google are all developing technology which makes it easier for, say, digital advertising to be able to attribute in-store presence. And that's largely what Ripple Metrics is about.
For sure. Is Foursquare still a thing, by the way? Is
that I Googled them and they seem to still exist. So
I know they still exist, but yeah, is it being used? That's interesting. Yes. Maybe they've tried some new things.
Yeah, so Foursquare's out there. But we're seeing even with our product that products, you need to be able to get the full view now, right? It's no longer about POs and purchase orders and just seeing, okay, once the purchase order is done, and a lot of our webinars and content go into this stuff as well.
Yeah,
you need to look at the full view. So you need to optimize your supply chain and make sure that your supply chain management is perfect and that's going from warehousing to the supplier, and making sure from there you're tracking your point of sale and making sure that you're able to see how many products you've sold in store. From there, you need to be able to attribute marketing dollars to sales and be able to see where your sales lifts are coming from. But you also need to understand that the customer journey isn't necessarily a linear process, and it can deviate quite significantly. So that's extremely important for managers now. And I wanted to highlight Ripple Metrics as kind of an example of an organization that's using data and helping organizations leverage data to be able to better see this customer journey from start to finish.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting, and I think we'll keep seeing this evolve more and more over the years. There's so many different things that we could be tracking, so this is great.
So the end of another episode has arrived. I just really want to quickly touch on everything that we've gone through today. So on our winner's side, we had retail in general for a really great month of September in the United States, and Frank Body. We also, on our loser side, pardon me, we had L'Oreal and Tootsie Rolls. For the retail roadmap, we had a look at indie beauty brands, and we finished off in the data dive looking at Ripple Metrics and metrics in store. So that's another episode done for another week. If you haven't gone back and listened to any of our previous episodes, please do so. Also, please jump on iTunes and review us, send us emails, fire us feedback anywhere you can to let us know what we can speak about, and let us know some topics that are close and dear to your heart so we can continue to have some great conversations about retail. See you next episode.